This is history in the making. You're going to want to tell your grandkids and their grandkids and their grandkids.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
The rest, as they say, is history.
Now, what about wrong time, harbingers and fossils, things and people that turn up in surprising time periods? Have you heard about this story about the about the Charlie Chaplin time traveler? Have you heard about that whole thing?
No, not at all. Oh, sorry, yes, the mobile phone walking across the screen.
Yeah.
One of the things I try and do in my blog is not deal with stuff that's on the news. I want to put up a post that will surprise people. But that's the kind of thing that if I'm still blogging in 5 years, I'll put up a post on that. That's exactly the kind of thing, the Charlie Chaplin film that seems to show someone using a mobile phone. Who knows what the explanation there is. I guess what I'm looking for are examples of people who, way before their time, come up with things or systems that then vanish and are lost. And in a sense, what we were talking about with the Vikings in North America, a nice example of that.
Yeah.
But, of course, there are lots of others. I mean, for example, we always talk about flight at the very beginning of the 20th century. But there are several interesting examples before where it's just possible that someone may have invented something close to flight. So that would be, for me, an example of people turning up too early at a time when the idea wasn't really ready to come to fruition. And then, of course, it goes the other way. There are extraordinary examples of things in history that we take for granted, that they disappeared in a given period, but are actually there, hidden beneath the surface for centuries and centuries. I'll give you a very nice British example. The British Celts occupy Britain in the early millennia BC, perhaps 1000 BC, unlikely to be much later. And then in the 5th century, the early English come in and they essentially take over much of Britain, the part of Britain that becomes England, and their parts of England begin to speak English and the Celtic languages die. That at least is the orthodox explanation. But within England, we know that right into the late 20th century, in parts of the north of England, there were shepherds who spoke Welsh, Celtic language, when they counted their sheep. Only in that one example. When they would go out and count their sheep, they wouldn't count going 1, 2, 3, 4, and these were all English speakers, remember, they would count using Welsh numerals. And the best explanation for this, though it's one that I just find almost impossible to credit, is that Welsh, British Celtic, a Celtic language, had survived in the north of England from the 7th century, say, when these areas were overrun, all the way through to the late 20th century. It's just extraordinary. And that's another lovely example of these records simply not appearing in earlier writing. Even in the rush of material in the late 18th and early 19th century, it's not until we get into the late 19th century that people begin to notice that shepherds in some parts of the north of England have these strange counting habits.
That is strange. Yeah, you wonder about these little things that turn up like that.
Mm.
In a way, that's a perfect, I guess, segue for the last of the eight categories. That's what the hell, my God, or even I don't understand this reference at all, sort of things that stump you. So I guess talk a little bit about what are the stories that stump you in particular?
Well, I think this is actually the tag I tend to use the most. And I just really, because it explains so many of my posts, or it expresses so many of my posts, that there are just issues here that I simply do not understand what is happening. And perhaps in a sense, it's my plea to readers to please get in touch and enlighten me if they can, or stories that have shocked me. I think one that I've become very interested in the last few weeks, I put up a post about several 19th century records of eagles picking up babies and carrying babies away. And what amazes me about these stories is the evidence just seems to be overwhelmingly good, in that we have witnesses, we have very convincing sounding stories, and yet when you actually look at the eagles in question and the countries that are involved and the type of eagles we're talking about, it is virtually impossible that these eagles could have even picked up a newborn baby. given the weights involved.
Yeah.
And so then you have the whole question is, well, what is going on here? And in my post, I examined some of these news stories and suggested that there were a suspicious number where names were not given, or the names that were given were suspiciously general names. Smith, Jones, these very common kind of names. And I suggest at the end that, in fact, probably most of these stories, if not all of them, are just legends. And so my what the hell has really transformed into a cobbler, to use another of the tags that I described earlier, that these are tall tales, if you like, that naive or mercenary journalists included in their newspapers. And it's not to say that Eagles will never attempt to attack people, and it's not to say that Eagles will never attempt to attack children or babies, but they're more likely to do so either as they perceive it to defend their territory, perhaps the approach to their nest, or perhaps because they just miscalculate, they think they can lift a young baby. I'm not making the case here for eagle sentimentality, I'm just making the case for physics, that the eagles are just not up to the job of lifting and carrying.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That covers the eight categories, so obviously...
Could I bring one in? Because, I mean, one of the things, those eight categories, I think I wrote that, the description of those eight categories, when I was beginning.
Mm-hmm.
However, since then, I've added a couple, and I'd love to give some space to one of these.
Sure.
Which is what I call my rogue researchers category, and I promise that sooner or later I'll put a link into this. So far, I've only put up three posts on this.
Yeah.
But I think that as I spend a lot of my time in the academic world, I'm always amazed by the extraordinary things that academics sometimes get up to in trying to prove or test historical theories. And this is another one of my favorite stories. Essentially, there are lots of debates about how the mayor sacrificed their victims. And I came across this fabulous, fabulous story. And again, I found this in an academic article. It's the kind of thing that most people would never come across. But there's the whole question of how they got to the beating heart that they would then extract from their victim. Typically, the victim would be drugged, then they would put in the knife and extract the heart. There's the whole question of how they did it. And a couple of Spanish authors, in cooperation with colleagues in Mexico, actually managed to convince, and I just find this incredible, I mean just beyond belief, but they managed to convince a morgue, a public morgue in Mexico, to simulate Mayan human sacrifice, presumably on their John Does. I mean, I have no idea, but I mean, presumably no family would have ever. I mean, it's one thing to let your son's heart be used in a transplant. It's another to further the knowledge of Spanish academics. But that they actually tried to replicate the daggers used and did different experiments to see how it would have worked. And they came to an interesting and useful conclusion. But I just love the idea that academics were actually prepared to effectively simulate sacrifice on real-life corpses in the 21st. I think it was the very late 20th century. And so that's something else I hope to develop, these rather wacky academic stories where academics go far beyond the call of duty and arguably, perhaps wrongly, beyond the call of duty in trying to get to the bottom of various historical mysteries.
Well, you know, science will not be stopped, right? Isn't that...
That's right, that's right. It's all downhill.
Yeah. Now, one of the sort of recurring elements on the blog, beyond the categories, is you seem to find a lot of interesting stories regarding food, which I think, obviously, everybody eats. So, you know, these would resonate with people, I think. And talking about bizarre, I mean, some of these stories are pretty strange. Like things people ate, how they prepared food, and all kinds of stuff like that. So I guess talk a little bit about, you know, some of your favorite weird historical food stories.
I think one of the things I'd say just first, one of the experiences of writing a blog, and I don't know if this is something universal or not, I try to mix and match a lot. But what I find is every so often I go through phases where I go crazy about something. So, for example, a couple of months ago, I had the moment where I went crazy about elephants. There was a period when I was crazy about birds. And at the moment, I'm definitely in a food phase where I happen to find lots of food stories. It just seems to come and go that there are these strange tastes in the same way that sometimes we want vanilla ice cream or sometimes we want chocolate ice cream. Sometimes I just get these tastes and perhaps go down one street a little bit excessively. Mm-hmm. As far as food stories go, I mean, there were several. There's the story of the sandwich on the early Apollo flight, the sandwich floating through in the weightless atmosphere. I mean, one of the things that fascinates me is the origins of pasta. This is something I've been reading a lot about recently. The possibility that pasta was something that came out of the Arab world into Sicily, where the first spaghetti factories were made. I came across a lovely story recently that I put up a post about, that in Central America in the 17th century, there was a cathedral where it was normal for the ladies at high mass to have their servants bring in steaming hot cocoa drinks just as mass was being served. And what I find extraordinary about this story, and I think, I'm not sure if anyone has really put two and two together here, I find it difficult to imagine they haven't, but from our sparse knowledge of Mayan sacrifice, chocolate seems to have been associated with blood sacrifice. Drinking chocolate may have been the prerogative of someone about to be sacrificed, or possibly someone who was doing the sacrificing. If this is the case, the fact that, and what's interesting about the ladies in question is that these were Spanish or Creole people who'd settled there, had been there for a couple of generations. If they were taking cocoa before taking mass or associated with mass, I mean, it's irresistible, the connection between the fact that they would be taking the blood and body of Christ and that they're taking cocoa. I mean, it just seems to be something that lines up with pre-Columbian beliefs about sacrifice.
Yeah, interesting. Now, also, there was one here on biodynamics. Let me see if I can find that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lovely story. I mean, essentially, biodynamics. I have quite an interest in organic food, the whole question of whether organic food tastes better, whether it's better for us or not. And recently I've become fascinated by the whole question of where the organic food movement comes from. And I was interested how much of the organic food movement has its roots, at least in industrial times, in Nazi Germany or in 1930s Germany just before Hitler, or even in 1920s Germany. 1920s Weimar Germany before Hitler was a very unusual place where many of these rather peculiar ideas got a hearing. And some of these were then taken up by the Nazi Party when it came to power. And because of the nature of Nazi power, all you needed was someone high up in the party who had an interest in, say, seances or Tibet. And the next thing you know, then funding would be found for this particular project and off scientists would go. Now, what biodynamics has is really, is it's, I described it, I think, in the post as a homeopathic version of organic farming, in that it's using peculiar techniques that are completely natural. But whereas organic farming just strictly uses natural techniques, I mean, really they're using techniques for biodynamic farming, which are essentially a cult. I mean, for example, if there are field mice causing problems, then catch field mice, kill them, incinerate them, and scatter the ashes. I mean, we're almost talking of sympathetic magic here.
Yeah.
But biodynamic farming does actually have a good record, and quite why this is the kind of thing that for me, someone who considers himself rather rational, I have problems with, but biodynamic farms that exist to this very day do have remarkable records of achieving record crops, and also very large and impressive vegetables. There's one famous biodynamic farm in Scotland, the Findhorn Farm, But what happened anyway with biodynamic farming was that the Nazis took it up. And I think it's too much to dishonor biodynamic farming in the sense that the Nazis took up many things. They took up Wagner. We still listen to Wagner. They took up Nietzsche. We still read Nietzsche. But they also took up biodynamic farming. And actually, biodynamic gardens were set up in the various German concentration camps and in their death camps.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Now, also, you talk about futurism, which I thought was interesting, because you hear some people described as futurists nowadays, but they're not really sort of like the futurists as they first came about. So I guess talk a little bit about, you know, the world of the futurist, if you will.
Well, I think that when you think of Nazi Germany and fascist Italy in the 1920s and 1930s. Nazi Germany comes in 1933, but fascist Italy is already there in 1922, essentially. You have there two dictatorships that are really quite different. Fascism seems to... let's start with Nazism. Nazism attracted, I would say, on its weirder edges, the occult, spiritualism, irrational beliefs. Whereas fascism, on its strange fringe, attracted this movement called futurism. And futurism was essentially a philosophical movement that wanted to do away with the past. And in a country like Italy, where the past weighs very heavily, where you can't walk down a street without bumping into a 15th century palace, I can kind of see where futurism was coming from. They wanted to modernize Italy. But the result was that they came up with lots of rather crazy ideas. And I'll just give you one of their most famous crazy ideas. They were sick of Venice. Venice, of course, the city of canals, one of the most beautiful cities in the world. They wanted to go into Venice and concrete over the canals and make them into racing tracks. So there was the idea that anything was old, they wanted to get rid of or sideline and replace it with the modern. Now, there was futurist music, there was futurist art, some of which is notable. There was futurist poetry, there were futurist novels, but there was also futurist food. And what the futurists did here, and in fact I had the great pleasure of trying some futurist food last week, so I'm very excited about this at the moment, but what the futurists did was they had a completely revolutionary way of looking at food. And I have to say, I'm not a convert, but I think they may have been on, at least partially, they may have been on to something.
Yeah.
What they said was that we all need nutrition. Okay, that's great. Let's just give people an injection in their butt or some vitamin tablets. Let's get that out of the way. Now, forget about nutrition. Now let's concentrate on giving ourselves interesting foods and drinks. Foods and drinks, not necessarily that will give us pleasure, because I think for many of us pleasure means bloating ourselves and falling asleep, but food and drinks that will shock us. And I'll give you an example of the two futurist foods I tried last week that I found absolutely fascinating. The first was called Italian breasts in the sun. No, really, they always had these very outrageous names. And it was essentially, I mean, it was unbelievably interesting to eat. And when I'm describing it, you'll probably think it was disgusting, but that's only about an eighth of the story. Most of all, it was just very unusual to eat. It was a series of ground almonds, mixed and ground very finely. A liqueur was poured over the almonds. A strawberry was placed on the top with candied fruit, and around the candied fruit was sprinkled very, very strong black pepper and chili seeds. Now, again, it sounds disgusting, but actually it was kind of weird and interesting because it was just touching so many different taste buds at the same time. Another food I had the same day were the futurist diabolical roses, which was just very simply buying a bunch of 12 roses, washing them very thoroughly, dipping them in a rather delicious batter, and then deep frying them. And again, who would eat roses? Well, actually, they're surprisingly interesting. The taste is curious. You have the taste of batter, but you also have the gentle rose taste that I'd never experienced before, but that was certainly curious.
Yeah, that is interesting. I've never eaten a rose before, so that does...
But it was a new experience for me too. What I would say to, especially to those of your listeners in the States, there were, I think, 4 or 5 restaurants in the States that still serve futurist food. I think it's a particularly famous one in Chicago. The problem is they tend to be incredibly expensive. Probably the best thing your listeners can do is get in touch with me and I'll scan them some pages and they can do their own ingredients at home.
Yeah. Now, what about here? I've seen another post here on invisible libraries, which I find interesting. Books or collections of books that have never existed except in the fantasies of readers.
Yeah, this was an idea that I think I came onto when I was probably even in my 20s. And I don't know if you know, there's a graphic novel writer named Neil Gaiman. And Neil Gaiman, in one of his novels, describes a what he calls a library of dreams, which were all the books that the great authors of the world thought of, but they dreamt of, they thought of, they imagined, but they never had time to write. And I always thought, for example, there's a famous G.K. Chesterton novel named The Man Who Was Thursday, and in the library of dreams in this graphic novel, there's a book called The Man Who Was November. G.K. Chesterton was a Catholic writer, and I think what Neil Gaiman was trying to say was that here we actually have G.K. Chesterton not being Catholic, but almost being, can we say, pagan, going back to older religious ideas. And so I've always been fascinated by this idea, not just of books that have vanished, but books that never existed, but that people imagined and conjured up. And so what I did with this was I've looked for various lists through time, written by authors or wits, of books that should have existed, if you like. And I've given various examples on the post, but I think my favourite example is from the time of the forgery of Hitler's diaries. I suppose we're in the very late 80s. The forgery of Hitler's diaries found that Spiegel, the German magazine, was buying up all the diaries of Hitler that he was faking. And so he put together a list of other documents that he believed he could get hold of, in other words, that he knew he could forge, and gave it over to Spiegel. And to read this list today is just comic because, I mean, it's a Nazi historian's wet dream in the sense that it's just a whole series of the kind of books that someone who studied Nazi history would mortgage their house to get their hands on.
Yeah.
It's just too good to be true. And what makes me laugh about this list is really that anyone with a modicum of common sense seeing this list should have said, this is too good to be true.
Yeah.
This doesn't make sense. And yet, that didn't happen. Spiegel was taken in, and they continue to put money aside for these extraordinary works.
Bizarre history, man. That's, you know, it's unbelievable. I'm looking at one here on your blog that just completely blew my mind, and that is these Confederate exiles who left America after the Civil War and settled in Brazil, somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000 Confederate sympathizers or Confederate soldiers or whatnot, Southerners, if you will, who went to Brazil and formed their own little community there. I guess talk about that, because I'm sure a lot of the listeners have never heard this story before.
Yeah, I find it amazing that this isn't better known in the United States. I have to say it's reasonably well known in Brazil. The Brazilians know that there was this influx of Confederate soldiers, Confederate families, not just immediately after the Civil War, but also during Reconstruction, when many Southerners became very disillusioned with the way things were going. And what happened was that families left the Southern states, and the Brazilian government actually privileged them, and they believed, probably rightly, that these southern families would bring in new farming techniques, important innovations, and slavery was still legal in Brazil at that date. So what happened was many of these families went down there, began their lives again, and there's one very moving gravestone that describes one of these, the son of one of the settlers in this small Confederate community outside São Paulo. And on his gravestone, there's this wonderful epitaph where it says, three times the rebel. And why is he three times the rebel? Well, he's three times the rebel because he rebelled against the Union. He then rebelled against the settlement and left the southern states to go down. And then he also takes part in an early, late 19th century civil war in Brazil, where he rebels against the central government. So his idea is that he's this triple rebel. And I love this romance of these, you know, of the eternal rebel. And these communities survived, and to some extent they survived to this very day, though by now they virtually all speak Portuguese. I mean, I think the last English speakers were dying out in the 1950s. And of course, some of them have come to the States and learned English. It's an important part of their destiny. And if any of your listeners are interested in this, there is a yearly festival that they put on just at the graveyard and the church of the original founders of the community. There's also, and I've not done a post on this yet, but I look forward to doing so, there's also a town in the north of Mexico where many Confederates went after the surrender.
Interesting. Yeah, it's weird. People, you know, turning up in strange places goes back to that post earlier. Now, what about mysterious, like, animals? You know, there's a lot of, like, mythological type creatures, and then there's, you know, accounts of people who describe them and stuff. How much do you think that's hyperbole and legend, and how much do you think maybe that some stuff we've written off as hyperbole and legend, you know, we might have gone extinct or we might have missed somehow?
I mean, I have quite a big tag on cryptozoology, and I think that my perspective on this is that, again, I consider myself a fairly rational person. I believe in the rational universe, and when by the time we get to, I don't know, ghosts, etc., I do start to have some problems, though I confess between you and I to a fascination. But cryptozoology, I think, for me, is a kind of illicit version of that, because, of course, we know all the time that new animals, birds, insects are discovered month by month in the world, and presumably the number of large sea mammals or the number of large mammals that remain to be discovered will be relatively small now. But I do have a fascination for these things, and I do often ask myself, do some of these ancient and medieval descriptions of bizarre creatures actually, are they hiding the description of either an animal that we know but that is being seen in an unfamiliar fashion, or even an animal that no longer exists but that once did exist? And this is something that I find just fascinating. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, I put up a post on the Moas of New Zealand, a 19th century letter to a New Zealand newspaper from a gold prospector on the Southern Island who'd been walking through a wood and walks into 2-3-meter-high birds that were Moa. Now, if he was telling the truth, and I suspect either he's lying or telling the truth, I just can simply not believe that there would be a misunderstanding here, then there were Moa in late 19th century New Zealand, and this is an animal that has died out. Now, we know that the Moa once existed. There's no question about this. We dig up their bones all the time in New Zealand. Most historians believe that they died out a couple of generations after the Maori arrived in New Zealand. But is it possible that there are other animals and birds that no longer exist, but that were actually described in our history books? And surely the answer is yes. One of my favorite examples that I give in the blog is a visitor, a Italian visitor to Mecca in, let's see, the very early 16th century. And we believe that this Italian converted to Islam before converting back to Christianity. He was arguably the first Westerner to go to Mecca. And in a compound at Mecca, he sees 2 unicorns. And he describes these animals with great care. And they sound like unicorns. They have a single horn. Now, if there was just one animal, then we would be looking at some strange genetic throw. We would be looking at a deer, and this is something that we know well from the world, that sometimes 2 horned deers just have one horn that happens to grow in the middle of their forehead. Mm-hmm. But we have 2 of them. I mean, what on earth was he seeing? And again, I would just love to say that he's an unreliable chronicler, but he's actually a very reliable chronicler. Historians always comment on how reliable he is. This wasn't something he'd heard from someone else. He saw it himself. He didn't see them at a distance. He sat and watched them. How do you explain that? I have not the slightest idea. I suspect there are no such things as unicorns and that unicorns have never existed. But this is the kind of account that fascinates me because there are no easy answers. And just last night, I hope to put this up on the post sooner or later, I came across a reference in Arabian mythology to an animal that sounds very much like our unicorn. Goodness knows if that's connected or not with this story I've just recounted.
Yeah, you really wonder what we may have dismissed that we should go back and take a second look at.
Now, absolutely.
One of history's mysteries that always sort of has fascinated me, and we're working on trying to get a guest on to, you know, do a full show about it, and that's the big Shakespeare debate about whether or not he wrote the plays and all that, contentions. So what's your, as a historian, I'm sure you've examined this issue before, so, what's your take on that whole argument?
Well, I've done a couple of posts on Shakespeare already, and I've done one post that I find one of my burning library posts about the possibility that some letters from Shakespeare survived into the 18th century when they were thrown away by an inattentive housekeeper. But this whole question of Shakespeare, did Shakespeare really write the plays or not? I'm afraid that I will give you the boring answer here. I suspect it is as it's told to us. One of the things that convinces me that it is that it's true that in the 16th century there was a pseudonymous tradition. In other words, the idea that you write in someone else's name. But I just cannot think of a conceivable reason, and I'm sure there will be many listeners who are rearing up in their seats with fury, that why even a noble writer would have bothered to write in the name of an actor when, in fact, there was always the possibility of just simply inventing a name completely. That's one of the things that's always stuck in my mind. I think the other thing to say is we don't have much biographical information on Shakespeare, but what we do have, there are some lovely stories about his womanizing, for example. What we do have squares very well with the kind of personality I imagine wrote those plays.
Okay, interesting. All right.
So I'm giving you here the conventional answer, but let me just give you an outrageous thing on Shakespeare that I'd love to write in a post sooner or later.
Sure.
In the same way that in the United States, the whole question of the Confederate settlement in Brazil doesn't seem to be very well known, but in Brazil it is. In Britain, and I suspect in the United States, no one has ever heard of the Italian Shakespeare theory, but in Italy this is very big. And this is the idea that Shakespeare was Italian. And this is a very peculiar idea, but the notion is that Shakespeare actually came from a family that seems to have been Catholic at a time when it was no longer normal to be Catholic, and that his family has a name that translates very easily into Italian, and that arguably his father was an Italian exile. Shakespeare also knew some Italian and perhaps a lot of Italian. And his plays, time and time again, seem to show evidence of knowledge of Italy that goes beyond just banal, normal knowledge. There seems to be a very good chance that Shakespeare travelled in Italy. And I think that one of the interesting things about Shakespeare, and there are other individuals in history, Jesus is perhaps the most famous example, where we have a huge gap in Shakespeare's biography from his childhood years to when actually he becomes an accomplished writer and actor. And we don't know what happened then. Is it possible that he lived in Italy, that he travelled extensively in Italy, or is it even conceivable that his family was Italian? Anyway, that's something to ask your guest when you finally get him on the show.
Absolutely, yeah. I never even heard of that whole aspect of the theory, and the guy I'm looking at takes the conventional approach like you, so yeah, he's not introducing, he actually, I think, goes point by point through the various, suspects and explains why it's not likely them or something.
Why it doesn't
like
add up, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you piqued my interest here when you said you went through an elephant obsession, because, you know, first of all, that's just strange in and of itself, and then you tie that into bizarre history, and it makes you wonder what kind of stuff you uncovered with elephants. First of all, how did you even get on an elephant kick, and what did you discover with regards to elephants and bizarre history?
Well, I think the great thing about elephants is this, that we of course, we're all used to elephants, because we've been to zoos, we've seen television programs. But in the ancient world, elephants had two special features. First of all, they were huge and frightening animals. If someone saw an elephant for the first time who had never seen an elephant before, it wasn't like seeing a cow for the first time or seeing a sheep for the first time. The likely reaction wasn't fascination, but sheer horror. The second thing is that elephants have a long relationship with humanity, because they are war animals, and I think this is the key. They were used in wars. And so, because of this, what you have are occasionally in history armies turning up with 200 or 300 elephants in places where no one had ever seen an elephant before. And the thing that got me started on this is that we know that in 43 AD, when Claudius, the Emperor Claudius, invades Britain, he brings a couple of elephants with him. And I've always asked myself, what on earth did the British warriors who met the Romans think when they saw these creatures? Because there is just nothing in the British fauna, there's nothing in European fauna that comes close. I mean, what do you think when you see an elephant for the first time? And the closest was presumably a cow that happens to be about 50 times too big. I mean, it must have been absolutely terrifying. But anyway, from there, I went on to look at various other elephant stories. I think I became a little bit cryptozoological with some of the whole question about mammoths. Did they survive? I found a rather crazy guy from the 19th century who alleged that elephants made it into North America. And I also found Mongol elephants, no less. And I also found a lovely account looking at some Mexican pre-Columbian remains. Honduran pre-Columbian remains, alleging that there are designs in these pre-Columbian remains of Indian elephants. And I argue that this isn't the case, that we have a cobbler story here, but still it's very colourful. And one of the things I very much hope to go on with the blog if I have time and energy and health, and I was actually thinking of instituting a yearly elephant week where I just do blogs, just do posts on elephants. And I already, I still got something like 6 months to go, but I already have my 7 elephant stories ready. So.
Oh, wow. Well, they are a peculiar creature, that's for sure. So I'm sure, you know, as you said, they're one of a kind. So when you see them.
There's also the question, and this was another of my blogs, that my posts rather never really got picked up on, that I hope sooner or later someone will stumble on and be able to illuminate the question for me. There's the whole question really of when elephants were last used in warfare, because we know that even today Burmese tribes use elephants for transporting goods against the rather horrible Burmese government, the junta there. We know as well that the Viet Cong in Vietnam used elephants to transport things. But I found a couple of examples from the late 19th century where elephants actually took to the field of battle and attacked, but at the very end of the late 19th century, at a point where European armies were using artillery. I mean, it's just extraordinary.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. We're primarily a paranormal show, so I'm sure people will be interested in this one. I found this account that you post in the blog pretty interesting. This is the musings of a 15th century writer on the nature of extraterrestrials.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think this is something that I've always been fascinated about, that through history, you do have speculations about creatures on the moon, in the sun, on the planets, when people begin to understand that the planets are not other suns, or that they're different from the stars. And then even on the stars as time goes by. And you also have speculation about creatures living, I mentioned before, in the sun as well. So there were various, I've always found this interesting, that speculation about E.T. is not a modern thing, and I've always liked going back into the past when I stumble upon one of these references and recording it. And I think probably my favourite references actually come from the 19th century. I have a post on the blog about a celebrated case from New York, I think in the 1860s, when a New York newspaper claims to have found reports from Scotland that a noted astronomer had been observing creatures on the moon through his very powerful telescope. And one of the things that crops up in the 19th century, but that actually you can trace all the way back to the 16th century, is that as this is a very Christian period in history, people begin to worry about the souls of these creatures. And you start to have preachers standing up and saying, well, if there are creatures on the moon, we need to convert them. You have theologians writing articles where they say, well, do extraterrestrials have souls? You have all these questions here that to me seems incredibly obtuse, but clearly mattered awfully to these people. So no, it's all a fascinating question. I think there's also the interesting point that we have a period in early medieval history and perhaps in ancient history where people begin to place other races, other beings, fairies, gnomes, dwarfs, etc., on distant lands, the other side of the world, the Antipodes. The ancients used to believe in a spherical globe with continents that were out of our reach on the other side of the globe. And I've never really found the missing link, but what I suspect happens is slowly these ideas fall out of favor and the extraterrestrial life replaces them. And that, so instead of having fairies living in the Antipodes, we have a report, for example, from the 8th century saying that there are continents on the other side of the world and that King Arthur and the fairies live there. What happens is that later on, creatures on the moon, creatures on other planets replace that. And so the other night I was watching with my daughter E.T., that you can trace really E.T. all the way back, not to the first reference to E.T. In the 15th century to extraterrestrials, to alien life, but the first references to fairies living in other dimensions and other places way back when in the Middle Ages and then beyond into antiquity.
Yeah, yeah. It does seem to be the case. It's a big theory amongst people in the UFO field that, you know, these stories were just misattributed extraterrestrials. Yeah.
I mean, there's also all that question as well. I suppose that I'm not a big UFO believer, but there's certainly the possibility. I mean, of course, you don't have to be a UFO believer to think this, but I mean, it is interesting that certain phenomena, certain natural phenomena, for example, and the classic example is the Aurora Borealis, could have been misinterpreted in different periods as different things. And it's interesting, for example, that in the Dark Ages, the Aurora Borealis seems often to have appeared at times when Europeans believed that there were dragons in the sky and that we can actually trace the connection between these two. I mean, is it possible that in later centuries this turned into a belief in fairy activity, say? I mean, there are all these questions of misperception, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah. And you make a point, too, that, yeah, we may someday figure out that UFOs and these sort of things are something completely different that, you know, discovered weather phenomena or something.
That's right. I mean, one of the things doing this blog, it's something else I've learnt about myself and about writing, is that, as I was perhaps hinting earlier, I'm a bit of a skeptic, a rationalist where many paranormal things come into play, but I do find the whole field infinitely, infinitely fascinating. But one thing I find, and one of the things I enjoy writing posts now, is that often, even if I disagree with people, just the sheer colour of the stuff that people come up with is just wonderful. Even if I disagree with it, this is stuff that's just too good to let go. And I'll just give you an example of, I hope in perhaps January or February to do a week of posts on King Arthur. And when I do so, I mean, one thing that struck me is that the origins of King Arthur are incredibly interesting. But for me, almost more interesting are just the absolutely out of the left field theories that people have come up with in the last 200 years to explain King Arthur, that King Arthur was an alien, that King Arthur came from Ireland, that King Arthur was Russian, that King Arthur was a Celtic god. That, do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
That whatever the truth behind these things, we need to celebrate the sheer wealth and richness of the theories, because whether they reflect badly or well on humanity, they're very entertaining reading.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure. Now, we've talked here like nearly 2 hours, and I'm sure I'll get emails from people, you know, if I don't sort of follow up on this. So I guess,
sure.
Can we talk a little bit about the name, the beachcombing name? I obviously, this is a pseudonym. Is there a reason behind that? Is it sort of like because this is your moonlighting doing this blog, so you're sort of keeping it under wraps from somebody, or is it just, you know, I've noticed also that your posts have a fantastic sense of humor, so that I may tie into that as well, so I credit you for that.
Well, I think there were probably a couple of reasons behind it. I mean, first of all, the name itself. I think beachcombing, before my health went to hell a couple of years ago, I always used to hope that later in life I'd publish a book, Beachcombing, that would be perhaps a series of different, strange, peculiar stories from history. This was one of my ambitions at that time. And so when I came to write a blog on the subject of bizarre history, beachcombing just seemed a natural title. And giving myself this name, it was a name I felt very comfortable with. I like writing posts because I can always sign myself off as Beach, which is a name I quite like. You know, in another life, I could quite happily be called Beach, I think. And I think it expresses my vision of history, that history is quite random, and that the best historians can really do is walk along the beach of history and just pick up the odds and ends that are washed onto the shore by the sea of the past. And really, this is what I'm doing in the blog. I'm not doing it in a systematic fashion. I'm just picking up the pebbles, the messages in the bottle, the pieces of wood, the pieces of the you know, various shoes that have been discarded and washed up on the beach, and enjoying them and sharing them with a wider public. I mean, as to why I do it, I think in the beginning, when I started off, I probably just did it because I didn't want to humiliate myself. I was going to do a blog, and if I was going to put it up in my own name, and this probably reflects badly on my self-esteem and sense of worth, but I just felt, well, you know, what am I? If I put my own name up there, I'm going to feel very invested, but almost over-invested. And the result is that I'm going to feel very self-conscious about the whole thing, whereas if I put a pseudonym, I can just simply, if it goes wrong and I do it for a month and get bored, I can just escape and pretend it never happened. But then, actually, when I started off the blog, and by writing it in this persona of beachcombing, I found that actually, and this was the first time I'd done anything like this apart from a couple of novels I'd written earlier in my life, I think that by writing with a different name and a different personality, or perhaps it would be truer to say an aspect of my personality, perhaps the grumpier aspect of my personality, I found it gave me a tremendous sense of freedom. It was almost therapeutic. It was something that brought me great joy. So much so that I now have the problem that when I have to write other things sometimes, I sometimes forget I'm not beachcombing, and start writing with that voice that I use on the blog, and I have to blink a couple of times and just cross things out and then start again. And that's really how it's worked out. And I have to say that I wasn't aware of this when I started, but now this will be the other reason I'm glad I used the pseudonym, even if this wasn't the original reason. I mean, there's no problem as far as my life as an author goes, but I also teach at university, and I think that some of the material I deal with, perhaps as a political aspect, sometimes a fairly racy aspect. I don't like to think of my students reading my blog. I don't like to think of my department head reading my blog. And so for me, it gives me a tremendous sense there as well of freedom, where I can imagine myself censoring myself on some issues if there was ever the question of people who were close to me in my professional life reading it. And I'm sure that sooner or later this will come out, and I'm not particularly worried when it does, but I have to say for now it does give me this extra sense of an extra barrier between myself and my professional life that I appreciate.
Yeah. Well, it affords you a certain amount of creative freedom, you know, to...
It does. It really does, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, you're an excellent writer. And as I said, the humor in the post is fantastic. I really, you know, they usually crack me up when I'm reading them, so...
Well, I'm very glad.
So you kind of alluded to it here. Now, the obvious question, you know, is what's next for you? Obviously, you're going to keep posting these blog posts and stuff daily. What are the chances that we're going to get our hands on a Beachcombing's Bizarre History book in the future? I mean, I think people would love that.
Well, there I have certain contractual obligations that I have to take seriously with publishing houses, with my agent. And so I have to think very carefully about this. But perhaps in a dream world, what I would like to do is publish a whole series. I mean, the great thing about writing between 500 and 1,000 words a day is that's what, 180,000 words a year? 200,000 words a year? I mean, that's 200,000 words is... It's what, three books? It's a lot of material. Now, my problem is that it takes a lot of time to write these posts. I would say that I try and write one a day. Sometimes I'm just too busy, so usually once a week I write maybe three in a day, so I have a couple in the pocket. But I would say that pretty much one day a week goes on writing the posts. And so for me, there's a whole question about whether I'll still be able to continue. I'd very, very much like to. There's also the whole question of my health. I think that this does me a lot of good emotionally. It means I can write and enjoy myself. But again, I have to take that into account. A second child, fingers crossed, will arrive in January. So I have lots of things on. But in an ideal world, what I would like to do is I would like to continue to develop the blog. I would like to invite people to write guest posts, so I'd have guest posts perhaps once a month or so from historians, from other writers, from other bloggers. I would also like to bring together a kind of a league of good history writers, perhaps set up an annual internet Oscars for history writers. I would also like to bring out a series of books with under the Beachcombing name. I've been tentatively offered by a British magazine a column with the Beachcombing name. That's another possibility for the future. I will then have the very difficult decision sooner or later of leaving behind the present site and actually, if things continue to grow at the present rate, putting on my own site, because at the moment I'm working on the WordPress format and of course I couldn't sell books out of there. If I did that, then there are whole questions about, well, perhaps I'd even consider doing some advertising so I could do a little bit less work on other things and concentrate more on the blog. I'm saying all this just to communicate to you that I do have ambitions to continue with the future, and I very much hope I'll be able to, and I hope I'll be able to create a series of books and writings around the Beachcombing theme that can be sold or sent out around the world. And one of the things that will be particularly important for me, I'd be very keen, I can't quite give these books away free, but I'd very much like to give these books just at the price of postage to the many people who've written into me with suggestions and stories and perspectives and corrections. I'd very much like to set up a list of people who I would just give books to in that sense.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, wow. Well, you know, as I'm sure you've seen and I've experienced myself here, and, you know, you build a community and it really sort of takes on a life of its own, and people really, you get surprised by the generosity and kindness of people out there, you know, who appreciate
your work. It's extraordinary. I feel really privileged. When I started the blog, this was something I never really took into account. I thought that I would have people write to me, but I suppose I didn't expect the quality of the people who wrote to me. The interest of their emails, the intelligence behind them, the curiosity. And B, I didn't expect just how pleasant people would be. I think that, I've now been doing blogging for about 6 months. I have not once had a rude email. Not once.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, not what I, yeah, no, I'm sure that if we spoke again in 3 or 4 months, I wouldn't be able to say that anymore. I must have just been very lucky. But especially given that I'm fairly opinionated on the blog, I've been really, really touched by people's kindness, and also the number of people as well who maybe don't write in with any information, but just say that they like reading the blog, and this is something that I've greatly, greatly enjoyed. And for me, it's also had the double advantage that after I'd been going about a month, I confessed the secret of my blogging to my family and friends, and now I include quite a lot of autobiographical stuff on the blog, and actually it's become my equivalent of Facebook, in the sense it's actually how a lot of my friends and family know what's going on in my life. By reading the blog, I mention what's happened today, you know, the car blew up, this kind of thing. It's proved from a whole series of different dimensions a treat, and that was something that when I started, I really just wasn't in my imagination, wasn't in my plans. That's been perhaps the most marvelous side of doing the blog.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, well, I discovered the blog about 3 weeks ago or so through the great folks at The Anomalist.
Oh.
Yeah, they're a fantastic website, and I was trolling for news there and said, what is this Beachcombing's Bizarre History? I've never heard of this blog, and then I just dove in. It really is a fantastic piece of work, and folks should definitely check it out. I hope they do. And so with that, let me just thank you once again for coming on the show, Dr. Beach, or Beach, I guess we'll call you, since we're kind of friends now, since we've talked for 2 hours. And I wish you the best of luck. You've alluded to your health a couple times. I hope things turn around for you. I hope you feel better soon, and you know, best of luck with the baby on the way in January. And you know, I just also wanted to say, you know, we have guests on here sometimes that you say to yourself afterwards, boy, I would love to sit down and have a beer with that guy. And you are definitely, you know, at the top of the list for sure amongst those guests. And I'm sure the listeners feel the same way as well. So hopefully someday in the future our paths will cross.
Well, thanks ever so much. I really enjoyed the talk.
That does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Allow me to offer some serious, humble thanks to Dr. Beachcombing for coming on the show and for giving us his first ever interview. We spent the last 2 hours talking about it, so by now you definitely want to check out his website, www.beachcombing.wordpress.com, beachcombing.wordpress.com, or just punch into your Google machine, Beachcombing's Bizarre History, and you'll find it straight away. Trust me, my friends, this is a website you're going to want to go out of your way to check out and spend some quality time at. It is outstanding. Moving right along now, it is time for BOA Audio listener feedback, but this episode is easily a week overdue, and folks have been waiting for the latest installment of BOA Audio for quite some time, so let's eschew this week's edition of BOA Audio listener feedback and get back to it next week. My inbox is still overflowing. I apologize to the folks who I said I would respond to. Like I said at the beginning of the show, my holiday season has been insane, and I promise I'm going to get down to business here on answering emails and getting serious once again here at the end of the show for BOA Audio listener feedback. If you want to reach me and let me know what you think of the program and of the latest guests or guests you want to see here in 2011 on the program, there are a number of ways to get in touch with me. You can go to binallofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com, and click the contact button, or just write to boaaudio@hotmail.com. And if you want to get more interactive, you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. We like to call it BOA's Paranormal Playground. It is home to a whole bunch of different cool and kooky characters who discuss the world of the paranormal as well as the world of pop culture. Join up at the official BOA forum to discuss BOA Audio, Binal of America, and the world of esoterica and beyond. Beyond those means, you can also find me on a whole bunch of different social networking sites, Facebook, Twitter, and MySpace. Befriend me, follow me, poke me, it's all good. I'd love to hear from you on those sites as well. So shoot me a line, share your thoughts, and in the future, your correspondence may be featured here on BOA Audio listener feedback. Up next, allow me to give thanks to the esteemed and infamous BOA staff. Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, our contributing cartoonist Andy Carolan, and our webmaster Jeremy Boston. The BOA staff has a whole bunch of columns that have been posted in recent weeks, and we've got a whole bunch of new stuff coming up as 2011 unfolds. While I have your attention, and since I'm reaching out here to the hardcore BOA audio listeners, we are looking to add at least a couple more writers to Banal of America here in 2011. I looked back at the calendar and realized that we did not bring in any new writers in 2010, which stunned me and kind of lit a fire under my ass a little bit here to reach out to you folks and see if anybody wants to join up at BOA and pen a column for the website. So shoot me a line if that's something you might be interested in, and we'll work out all the details there. No need for me to take up any more of your time. But if you feel like you have a voice and you want to talk more about the esoteric, BOA is definitely the place for you. So get in touch and we'll see what we can get going. We say it week in and week out, but it is the truth, my friends. If you're only listening to Banal of America Audio and you're not reading the columns at BOA, then you're only getting half the story. BanalofAmerica.com. Make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. Now comes the uncomfortable part of the show where I have to ask you all for your help to pay the bills here at BOA HQ. What you just heard was a nearly two-hour conversation with a guest who is in Italy. Trust me, my friends, that is not cheap, and you're going to be hearing even more international episodes as 2011 unfolds. So we turn to you now and ask you to make a donation. Help us out here at BOA. How do you do that? There's two methods to go about making a donation. You can go to banalofamerica.com and click the PayPal button. That's right there on the homepage at BOA. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe and secure. But maybe you don't trust the internet. Maybe you don't trust PayPal and you want to make a snail mail donation. Well, we've got you covered there because we have a BOA P.O. Box. Here is the address for the official BOA P.O. Box. Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And let me spell those out for you. Tim Banal, P-I-N-N-A-L-L, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, P-I-N-E-H-U-R-S-T, Mass. 01866. And as we've been noting here at the end of the program, if you're going to make a snail mail donation, if you're going to send something to the P.O. Box, first of all, please include your email address so I can shoot you a line and say thank you. And if you're going to make a donation via check, please make it payable to Tim Banal and not Banal of America, since my bank is very anal. And as if you don't need me to remind you once again, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the website and the audio series up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. Next week on the program, we have got a real barn burner of an episode for you, my friends. We're welcoming back longtime friends of the program, Greg Bishop and Nick Redfern, the UFO Mystics. They're coming back to the show for our annual examination of the past year in ufology. This time around, though, we kind of want to change things up a little bit. In the last few years, we really pored over the minutiae of the last 12 months. And it got a little tiring last year, I'll admit it, and I think Nick and Greg will as well. So this year we really opted for more of a free-form discussion on the state of UFO studies as 2010 came to an end. We did cover some of the biggest stories of the year, but more along the lines of how they reflect the field of ufology. Some of the stories we do look at include Stephen Hawking's warning about contacting aliens, China's big airport UFO event, the UFO nuke press conference. We'll remember Zachariah Sitchin, Robert Miles, and others we lost in the past year. And we'll talk about the Emma Woods controversy and the shakeup at MUFON. Plus, we'll look at cryptozoology as well as emerging esoteric trends as 2011 begins. It's no secret to the hardcore BOA audio listeners, Nick Redfern and Greg Bishop are two of my very best friends, not just in the world of the paranormal. Really, they're just two of my best friends in general. So this is really less an interview and more a conversation between three good friends who happen to all have a very serious interest in the world of ufology. And hopefully the episode will give you guys food for thought about where we as a field stand when it comes to unlocking the enigmatic UFO phenomenon. It's fast, it's loose, it really is a lot of fun. It's Greg Bishop and Nick Redfern joining us for our annual wrap-up of the year in ufology and an examination of the state of ufology as 2011 begins. And on that note, we close the book on another edition of BOA Audio. Once again, let me thank Dr. Beachcombing for coming on the show. Check out his website, beachcombing.wordpress.com. That should keep you pretty busy until the next edition of BOA Audio. And, of course, I want to thank all of the amazing BOA Audio listeners for your support of this program. You are the fuel that drives the machine. You are the BOA Audio listeners. You really amaze me week in and week out with your support of this program. So allow me to thank you once again for everything that you guys do. Thank you humbly for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Bedall, thanking you for listening and signing off.